loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker, and I'm joined in studio by co-host John Kiriakou. In our first hour, we take a look at two big stories. First, the Trump administration today announced new stiff tariffs on steel and aluminum produced by three of the country's biggest trading partners, Canada, Mexico, and the European Union, all of which vowed to retaliate. We're going to be talking with Vijay Prashad about the new trade war and what it means. And then we continue our weekly series every Thursday called Criminal Injustice, where we talk about the most egregious conduct of the courts, the prosecutors, the police, and how justice is denied to so many people in this country.
But before we get to those two stories, we'll go over today's headlines, including five that we'll cover in depth in the second hour. First, the European Court of Human Rights has found that both Lithuania and Romania violated the European Union's prohibition on torture. The two countries were found to have violated the rights of terror suspects who were tortured in CIA-operated black sites that were set up during the Bush administration. Next, the Virginia State Senate approved a bill yesterday expanding Medicare coverage to 400,000 low-income residents, putting an end to years of Republican opposition. The state assembly had already approved the measure, and Governor Ralph Northam said he would sign it into law as soon as it reached his desk. Then we continue our discussion on electronic monitoring on recently released prisoners. Electronic monitoring is a popular government alternative to prison, but it discriminates against the poor who simply can't afford to pay for the service. And if they don't pay, they go right back to prison. And then President Trump today pardoned conservative political commentator Dinesh D'Souza, who was convicted in 2014 of violating campaign finance laws. Trump said that D'Souza was, quote, treated very unfairly by our government, unquote. The move was applauded by conservatives on Capitol Hill. He's also reportedly considering a pardon for Martha Stewart and a commutation for Illinois Governor Rod Blagojevich. And finally, Karl Marx famously wrote that history repeats itself, first as tragedy and then as farce. The Cold War was a tragedy. The new Cold War is playing out as farce. That's the thesis of Dr. Jeremy Kuzmarov in his new book, The Russians Are Coming Again, which you can get from Monthly Review Press and Amazon.com. And in other headlines, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo met with high-ranking North Korean leader Kim Jong-chol in New York City today. Following the meeting, Pompeo said he did not know if the June 12th summit between Donald Trump and Kim Jong-un would take place, but said that progress had been made. President Trump canceled the June 12th summit last week, and intensive negotiations have been ongoing to get it back on track. Spanish Prime Minister Mariano Rajoy is set to lose a vote of no confidence and be ousted from his position. Today, the Basque Nationalist Party announced that it would vote against Rajoy, giving the opposition the votes necessary. The no confidence motion will take place tomorrow. President Trump waded into a bitter primary fight in New York's 11th congressional district, endorsing incumbent Dan Donovan over Michael Grimm. Grimm, a former U.S. representative, is running to the right of Donovan and portraying himself as more aligned with the Trump administration. The bulk of the 11th district covers Staten Island. The Turkish ambassador to the United States is returning to Washington. Ambassador Serdar Kilic was recalled to Turkey in protest of the opening of the U.S. embassy in Jerusalem earlier this month. In addition to Jerusalem, Turkey and the United States find themselves at odds over the YPG in Syria, as well as arms sales. Those are today's headlines. Next up is a discussion on EU tariffs. You're listening to Loud and Clear.
Loud and Clear.
The Trump administration today announced stiff new tariffs on steel and aluminum produced by three of the country's biggest trading partners, Canada, Mexico, and the European Union, all of which vowed to retaliate. The decision will likely raise prices on a wide array of products for Americans and may presage a similar move against China. We're joined from Massachusetts by Vijay Prashad. Vijay is the director of the Tricontinental Institute for Social Research and chief editor of Leftward Books. He's the author, most recently, of Death of the Nation and the Future of the Arab Revolution and Red Star Over the Third World. Vijay Prashad, welcome back to Loud and Clear.
Yes, thanks a lot, Brian.
Vijay, before the show started, we heard that you're in the United States, and of course that signals that something dramatic is going to happen. What's your reaction?
Well, I mean, to be honest, this is not dramatic at all. This has been on the cards for a long time. Mr. Trump had said several times on the campaign trail that he was going to take stiff action from his point of view against China. He hadn't actually come out so clearly regarding the Europeans, but you remember, of course, that he was quite strong on NAFTA and on the need to renegotiate the North American Free Trade Agreement. So this is not a surprise from that standpoint. Also, recently, that is within this last few months, his Commerce Secretary, Wilbur Ross, has been negotiating with the Mexicans, the Chinese, the Canadians, and with the European commissioners about questions of trade and issues that go around the questions of subsidies and tariffs. So this has been on the cards for a long time. 10 days ago, there was an agreement with the Chinese on postponing some of these measures, but I think they just sort of precipitously decided to take action. So one shouldn't be surprised that it's happened. I think the issue is, of course, what is this going to mean?
Vijay, the White House announced that these tariffs specifically are on steel 25% and aluminum 10%. The European Union said this morning that they would enact tariffs, but on things like motorcycles, blue jeans, and cranberry juice. Is that an equal kind of tariff, or are the Europeans hedging their bets?
No, well, in fact, the Europeans are playing a very interesting game. They well understand that the United States will have midterm elections this year, congressional elections. And so they've targeted certain vulnerable seats where, people who might have reconsider their own positions on tariffs and on the Trump agenda. So they've targeted seats, in Wisconsin and other places where there are exports of these particular goods, cranberry juice to Europe, jeans, motorcycles, and so on. So this is actually a political tariff. They're going after people whose districts rely upon the export of these goods into European markets. I think it's actually a very clever and naughty gesture, as it were.
I think that's very clever. That makes complete sense to me, and nobody's talking about that.
Well, I mean, they should be talking about it because, in fact, the Europeans are quite open about what they're doing. I mean, look, frankly, the Europeans are finding themselves between a rock and a hard place. They are unable to integrate with the rest of Asia because of American sanctions on Russia, and now American sanctions increasing again on Iran. Because of the pressure of the United States on China, the Europeans are going to have a difficult time integrating with the Chinese. So you see, what's happening in a way is that this is not the end of globalization. I think this would be a very narrow American-centric perspective to take. I think that we are at a hinge point where different kinds of globalization agendas are on the agenda. So, for instance, the Chinese, of course, have articulated a globalization agenda that is called the Belt and Road Project. And you see, in that project, the Europeans could very well find a home for their own economies. But you see, they are not able to do that because of these sanctions regimes. So they are squeezed between Trump's management of a declining globalization, that is American-led globalization, everybody integrates with the United States, and the emergence of the Chinese project. And so I think for the Europeans, this is particularly difficult. Not so difficult for the Chinese.
Vijay, before World War I and before World War II, the rivalries between the advanced capitalist countries, West Europe, the United States, and Japan, were such that after having divided and redivided the world's markets and the colonies and the spheres of influence over and over again, in more or less a peaceful way, that peaceful redivision ended and the powers resorted to war. And then 20 years later, another war. At the end of the Second World War, all of those major powers, with the exception of the United States, were devastated. I mean, literally devastated, annihilated in many, many ways. And the U.S. resurrected a new world order for them, whereby not just the allies of the United States, but even its adversaries, Japan and Germany, were rehabilitated. They were given access to at least part of the world market. They weren't you know, they weren't treated the way Germany was treated with the Versailles Treaty after World War One. And the United States sort of had a new modus operandi whereby all of these countries function more or less as junior partners for the United States. They were rewarded. They had access to markets. But in return, the United States provided guarantees. It feels like Donald Trump has calculatingly, deliberately blown up that post-World War II order that, one, not only mitigated or ameliorated some of the divisions between these powers, it avoided the, quote, scourge of war, meaning World War III. Do you see it that way?
I think you're right, Brian, but I think that I'd like to add one more piece of historical periodization. After World War II, because of the existence of the Soviet Union, the Soviet bloc, in fact, Eastern Europe and so on, and the existence of very aggressive new states in the non-aligned movement, the United States and the Western powers felt at that point that they were not able to drive globally an agenda of trade and development. You know, this is the reason why they scuttled the International Trade Organization meeting in Havana, Cuba in 1948. There was an attempt, you know, not only had the Western powers driven the agenda to create the International Monetary Fund, to create the World Bank, but they were also going to create an International Trade Organization. They scuttled that project because they were not able to fully control the dynamic of world affairs. After the collapse of the Soviet Union, after the collapse of, you know, the effective power of the non-aligned movement, eventually the World Trade Organization was created, and it was only created in 1994. You know, after these events had happened, when the United States felt that it was now, you know, effectively the only power on the planet. And since 1994, since this phase of globalization, which essentially was a globalization where the United States and its closest allies wrote the rules for everybody else, since that period, there's been a real fraying of the authority of the United States, especially on issues of trade and development. It's not just the rise of China. I think that's a narrow approach to this. You know, we saw in 2003 when India, Brazil, and South Africa stood up in the ministerial meeting of the World Trade Organization in Cancun and resisted the idea that Western Europe and the United States should allow the cotton farmers to be subsidized, and indeed that U.S. farmers should get subsidized rates for water. This was a very important debate that started in Cancun. It was a debate that went through the so-called Singapore issues. So what one has seen since around 2003 is the fraying of American authority. And that's exactly what I think one should, you know, remember when you think of this new trade war, these tariffs. These tariffs are an attempt by the United States to use extra economic force, essentially, to define the terms by which countries trade with each other. And I don't think this is going to work for the United States, although I do believe for the fate of the planet, this may not be a bad thing.
Vijay, I'm trying to understand the politics of this move. And yeah, I like to think I'm a pretty politically savvy guy, but I really don't understand this. Here we have the administration engaged in what, by all accounts, are very difficult negotiations with Canada and Mexico over the renegotiation of NAFTA, right? At the same time, we're involved in this tit-for-tat trade war, for lack of a better term, with China. And today we announce these sanctions that include now the European Union. So why go after all these different countries, which are really major trading partners, the biggest trading partners the United States has, all at the same time? Now, the president said in a tweet this morning that this was all about national security, that protecting American industry, and he relied on a 1962 law when he said this, protecting American industry is protecting American national security. But it's either more than that, it seems to me, or this is just a really misguided, bad policy that he's been unable to explain to the American people. What's your take?
Well, you know, on Wednesday, I published a column whose headline is Imperialism Has Had a Bad Week. And the focus of that column was essentially Iran and North Korea. Now, of course, it's had a worse week in the days since Wednesday. In other words, with this announcement of an all-fronts war on tariffs. You know, Mr. Trump has, I think, distinguished himself as a really bad manager of American power. To manage power of the scale of the United States, one has to be decidedly strategic. So the last people you want to alienate at a time when you're trying to, say, push against China are the Europeans. And certainly you don't want to alienate the Canadians. I mean, the Canadians are slavishly loyal to the United States on all aspects. Take the case of Venezuela. Just had a presidential election. Nobody was as slavishly loyal to the Lima Group, which is the group set up by the oligarchies of Latin America with Canada and the United States to basically overthrow the government in Venezuela. The Canadians, you know, went beyond what the Americans were doing against the Maduro government in Venezuela. So you would imagine, let's first deal with some of our adversaries. If your adversary is, let's say, China, tackle the Chinese question. Why go after your allies? I mean, in that sense, Mr. Trump is a terrible manager of the imperialist project, which I think, as I said just now, is very good news for the world. Because, you know, after all, let there be a trade war beginning between the large capitalist powers. The issue isn't whether there's going to be a trade war or not. I think that's inevitable. The question is, do the other countries of the world have the stomach and the vision to make something of it? I mean, are they capable of delinking their economies to some extent from this very deleterious global order and producing other kind of regional patterns? And on that, I'm not so confident. And therefore, I believe that it could turn out to be a very dangerous period for these countries. But this kind of trade war could, of course, produce the grounds for an alternative. So let's see what happens. I'm not confident that an alternative will emerge. But I don't think, you know, people on the left in particular should read this news and think, oh, this is terrible that there's going to be a trade war.
Yeah, indeed. One thing, let's just talk about the different sectors that constitute maybe not the left anymore, but parts of the working class movement. You have the Steel Workers Union and the Auto Workers Union. Now, of course, their membership, especially in the Midwest, has politically divided loyalties, but these were traditionally Democratic Party supporting unions. They are right now very supportive of Trump's tariff policies for very narrow industry-based reasons. And of course, steel and auto workers have been hit very hard. There's been a huge contraction of the workforce. And of course, Trump is now blaming foreign steel or foreign auto, not blaming the other, you know, characteristic and perhaps fundamental features that have led to a contraction in these industries, at least on the home front. But it appears to be, at least momentarily, something of a realignment, at least in those Midwestern states.
I mean, this is, in a sense, the failure of a left project to articulate, firstly, the reasons why there are these crises in certain important sectors. I mean, the steel sector is important because this is the, you know, most well-paid, used to be the most well-paid section of the American working class. In other words, this is a sector of people who could be, you know, what we consider vanguards of their class. But there's been no well-articulated narrative of why there has been this decline. For instance, just to give you an idea, I was looking at some statistics about reinvestment. You know, why isn't the left, and by left I don't mean the sectarian left necessarily, but even the Democratic Party progressives of one kind or the other, why are they not able to say, and obviously the answer is quite clear, but why aren't they not able to say that, listen, these industries, or particularly steel, has seen massive profit-taking and very little reinvestment in bringing in new technologies, you know, a smarter steel and so on. So what you're seeing is, you're seeing steel factories, when there's an opportunity to reinvest and bring it up to a technologically modern level, rather than that, you're seeing the shuttering of steel factories. In some cases, you know, the transfer of machinery elsewhere around the world and the death of these these companies. And so what one has to focus on isn't so much the trade war against China. I mean, that's how the bourgeoisie understands the decline of jobs here and there. But you see, we need to focus on how capitalist firms within countries like the United States have been indulging in a long period of massive profit taking with no responsibility to reinvest in their companies. This is what in the business world is known as arbitrage. They're making a calculation that it's far better in the short term to walk away with as much cream as possible from the firm than to maintain the firm in the medium and long term. This is the kind of argument I think that's very important to make to workers, that the question isn't the Chinese, because you know now you're going to restart, say, at full capacity, but you're restarting at full capacity in factories that are not necessarily the most modern factories, that are not necessarily producing the best steel, and that don't necessarily have the best working conditions. You know, so a much more robust and honest, I think, narrative needs to be out there about the decline of these sectors within countries like the United States, rather than turning this into, of course, you know, inter-capitalist rivalries, China, this, that, and the other.
Yeah, Vijay Prashad is our guest. You're listening to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. I'm joined in studio by co-host John Kiriakou. We're talking about the imposition of new tariffs by the Trump White House on the EU, on Mexico, on Canada, more to come on China. John, you know, Vijay is right. There's this false notion that exists, especially within the labor movement or the business union model, which is if something's good for the company, if it's good for U.S. Steel or if it's good for GM, it's going to be good for workers. But the fact of the matter is because the power of the company, of the enterprise, is completely concentrated in the hands of the board of directors and even a narrower part of it, they can decide whatever they want to do with excess profits. For instance, U.S. Steel stocks are surging right now.
That's right.
But they can take those extra profits and use it to automate their factories and get rid of workers. They will have excess capital to do that. And so it's the unions barking at the wrong moon. They're going down the wrong road because there's no salvation here. The real problem is that the workers are, you know, just completely dependent as a class on the company, on the bosses to give them a raise or to give them even employment. But there's no sort of guarantee that this will happen because the power is still completely vested with the companies.
Yes, I agree. You know, it may have been true in 1970 when people said that what's good for General Motors is good for the country. It's just simply not true anymore. And I agree with both you and Vijay that this support from organized labor or from union members of these tariffs is short-sighted and dangerous because in the end, of course, these companies are going to use the extra capital to automate. That's what they do. That's what they call progress. And in the end, people are going to be thrown out of work because of this.
Yeah, I mean, look, the issue is, of course, worker power and not what is the best policy from the managers of the system on behalf of workers. I would say that in some of these factories, yes, let us have robotics. Let us modernize. Then let us have a much broader question about shorter work, weeks. Let's come back to the discussion about the six-hour week and so on, you know, where we are able to control productivity, where we're able to use the fruits of productivity, you know, socially. I mean, those are very important broad debates, but they've basically disappeared from union halls and they've disappeared, of course, from political parties like the Democratic Party. I mean, I would imagine they would be horrified by a discussion of making an argument for an 8-hour or a 6-hour work week, not day, but a work week where you're working 8 hours a week for a whole week's wage. And, you know, that's the way forward. It's not to say let's return to the salt mines and send workers into, you know, coal mines and get black lung disease and so on. That's not the future. But I'm afraid that the labor movement and their political emissaries are still stuck in that mindset. You know, when Trump goes to the mining areas and says, we're pledged to restart the mine. I mean, I don't think that's a judicious idea. Forget on environmental grounds. It's hardly judicious on human grounds. You know, do you really want to go and get black lung disease? I mean, look at how the coal industry has treated its workers, not in the 19th century, but in this very century, in the last few decades. So these are broad, important questions. And I think they need to be, you know, there at the background when we're discussing these short-term issues like how to react to a tariff policy.
Vijay Prashant is our guest. Vijay is the director of the Tri-Continental Institute for Social Research and chief editor of Leftward Books. Vijay, we only have 3 minutes left, and so I want to ask you this question. I'm kind of puzzled by it myself. I think there's not just one answer. There's a lot of talk among, I would say, basically pundits or historians or academics about the fading power of the American empire. And yet when Trump or the U.S. government under whoever's leadership takes these very forceful policies like canceling the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action or imposing tariffs on the EU, you see again that the U.S. is asserting a kind of power that doesn't exist with any other country, any other government, any other economy. And so you even have very, very major, powerful, strong governments and countries and economies like Germany and France and the U.K., or Italy, having to, in more or less, kind of keep genuflecting before U.S. power. Is it really a fading empire?
Well, I mean, I generally feel like the debate about whether America is still an empire or it's a fading empire is missing the long point. And I think it's good you talked about historians. I mean, it's certainly the case that it was an aberration of history from the early 90s for the United States to put itself forward as the sole power on the planet. You know, it's a very short period when the United States government has been able to drive the agenda. The Obama administration tried to pick up what seemed to be some of the fraying authority by pushing, you know, this trade deal for East Asia, where Obama in the leaked documents quite clearly said this is about not allowing China to write the rules. I mean, what we have now is we have a long period where the United States authority is fraying to some extent. It is not declined. If it were declined, nobody would have paid attention to this news of the tariffs. But it's fraying. And I think the fraying is something we have to pay attention to. What does this fraying mean? What is coming out of this period? What is it going to look like? I think we need to look very carefully at that. It's too easy to say it's the end of the American empire. What does that even mean? I mean, are there forces capable of taking over the mantle? I don't think they are prepared at this time.
I agree with you. Very well put. That was Vijay Prashant. We've been talking to Vijay from Massachusetts. Vijay is the director of the Tri-Continental Institute for Social Research and chief editor of Leftward Books. Vijay, real quick, in 10 seconds, how can people learn about Tri-Continental Institute?
I would love it if they came to our website. It's thetricontinental.org.
All right, we'll leave it right there. That's Vijay Prashant. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker, and I'm joined in studio by co-host John Kiriakou. Today, we continue our weekly series. It's every Thursday, called Criminal Injustice, where we talk about the most egregious conduct of the courts, the prosecutors, the cops, and how justice is denied to so many people in this country. We're joined from Chicago by Kevin Gostala. He is a writer for Shadowproof.com and the co-host of the podcast Unauthorized Disclosure. And we're joined from Lake Worth, Florida, by Paul Wright, the founder and executive director of the Human Rights Defense Center. Paul is also the editor of Prison Legal News. Kevin and Paul, welcome back.
Thank you. Hi, thanks for having us on the show.
Let's begin. Before our show every week, we exchange some headlines, some big stories, the things that we think our audience might be most interested in or should be interested in, but might not be hearing about from the corporate-owned media. Kevin Gostala, why don't we get started with you? What are you looking at this week?
One of the stories that I wanted to share was from New Hampshire. We published this at Shadowproof. It's a story about how the Republican governor, his name is Chris Sununu, is going to veto or plans to veto a death penalty abolition bill that was introduced. And one of our reporter, someone who reported for us, Lauren Gill, to give credit to her, did this and is covering how basically it's so absurd and incredible that he would not want to sign this into law. This is actually a Republican bill. All they're going to do is change it to life sentence without parole for the state doesn't actually execute people. It's been a very, very long time since they've executed anybody. And in fact, I think there's only one person on there's only one person on death row. And just the expense, I mean, the state has spent $5.5 million on this particular person's case. And it's just incredible that Chris is going to veto it. But also the way in which he's defending the decision he's made is that he wants to be on the side of the victims' families and on the side of law enforcement. But what's incredible is this bill is supported by police in the state. It's supported by people who have been victims of these terribly violent crimes.
So what's driving Sununu here?
I think it's just crass GOP politics, basically, and just being intransigent and completely stuck in the mud here and unwilling to move on a certain issue.
You know, there are very odd politics in New Hampshire. New Hampshire has become, for the most part, a blue state, but they really do believe in this whole live free or die thing. And they resent when others try to tell them or when they perceive that others are trying to tell them what to do. And the death penalty is one of those issues. Even though a majority, not even a plurality, but a majority of New Hampshire's residents consider themselves to be politically independent, they tend to be slightly left of center, but still support the death penalty. It's inexplicable.
Go ahead, Paul.
Well, I was just going to say, John, is when you talk about live free or die, just remember every license plate in New Hampshire says that was made by a prisoner cranking them out in a prison industries program. So,
good point.
I think that's kind of more the mythology of individualism and freedom than an actual reality. But I think it's one of the things I think him makes a good point about, though, is the fact that, I mean, I don't remember the last time New Hampshire convicted or sentenced anyone to death or actually executed anyone. I think it's been decades since they actually executed anyone. And so at a base level, this is kind of more about, you know, the politics of it than anything else. And I don't necessarily think that we can ascribe the GOP as being the party of death necessarily, because, you know, I think we should note that Bill Clinton led the biggest expansion of the federal death penalty in American history when he was president. And, you know, then it was a Republican governor, Ryan, in Illinois that pardoned everyone on death row. So, you know, I don't think it's as simple as just saying that, yeah, well, just Republicans just want to kill everyone because, you know, the Democrats are pretty bloodthirsty, too.
Well, let's talk about what Clinton actually did, if we could, because it wasn't just that he made sure to go back to execute the mentally disabled guy, Ricky Ray Rector, to prove his sort of strong law and order credentials. The laws were changed, and this was after the Oklahoma City bombing, I believe, in 1995. But it was the Effective Death Penalty Act, where basically death penalty prisoners lost habeas corpus rights. Anyway, is that right, Paul?
Sadly, it wasn't just death penalty prisoners. It was all prisoners. I was one of the people that was affected by it, actually, as were hundreds of thousands of other prisoners. It was basically a change to standard of review for any state prisoners challenging their criminal convictions, as well as for death sentence prisoners in state and federal courts. So basically, it's really closed the courthouse doors, which were already kind of closed already on habeas issues. But it really kind of slammed the door shut on pretty much everyone in prison that was seeking to challenge their criminal conviction. But there's the federal crime control bill of 1994, which that's what led to the massive expansion of the federal death penalty, ended Pell Grants for prisoners to get an education, gave us a three strikes law at the federal level, and a whole bunch of other things.
Yeah, so it was called the Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act of 1996. It made it such, and correct, we're going to go on to other issues, but before we do, and I think it's important, and I'm glad Paul raised it, this was the Democrat, this was Bill Clinton, who was beloved by the Democratic Party and its base at that time, even after he was impeached. This was, again, after the Oklahoma City bombing, but what it basically did, if I'm not, again, Paul, correct me, So prisoners couldn't even if they were innocent, if their claim to innocence based on new evidence that had come forward, that by itself wouldn't be allowed in court for a possible retrial. Is that right?
Yes, that is correct. And, well, in fact, it's also worth noting, too, that the U.S. Supreme Court has never held that innocence alone is the basis for a new trial or to get a conviction reversed.
That's crazy.
It is. It's crazy.
I mean, the fact that you're innocent is not the basis for a retrial, even if you have the evidence at hand.
Right.
Right. And Justice Scalia said that just because you're innocent doesn't mean you didn't get a fair trial. And according to Justice Scalia's reasoning, and there are several other justices, you can be factually innocent and still get convicted and still have had a fair trial.
Yeah, I can't even comprehend that.
Of course. I mean, of course.
Well, that's police state logic.
It is police state logic, and it only is logical in a police state. Kevin, go ahead, and then we're going to go to some of the other issues.
Well, just to get a quick word in here about Democrats and how horrible they are, I'd like to just remind people that Hillary Clinton, during the 2016 election, was invoking 9/11 and other terrorism acts in order to justify not being for abolishing the death penalty. In other words, she was raising the specter of people like Timothy McVeigh and other, you know, and 9/11 just to say, hey, I'm not going to support ending this racist part of our justice system.
John, let's go on to some of our other stories.
Yeah, there's a story that was published today that I wanted to talk about. There was an African-American man in Florida who was shot and killed by the police in his own garage. After his death, his family sued the police, and the family won the case yesterday. And what happened was that the jury ended up giving the family $4 for the death of their relative, $1 for his funeral expenses, and $1 for each of his three children. The court also assessed that the police were 1% responsible for his death, and so the jury also gave 4 cents for punitive damages. It's again incomprehensible. I can't believe that something like this happens. We talked about this here in the studio amongst ourselves earlier today, and one of our colleagues said, you know, the money aside, a win is a win, and maybe we should be thinking about taking baby steps. And I think that's crazy.
That's crazy because it's not a win. It's just
it's a slap in the face.
And worse. Go ahead, Paul.
Well, I was going to say is that one of the things that, you know, talking to lawyers that have been doing police misconduct litigation for many years, literally for decades, one lawyer made a comment that in the 30 or 40 years he'd been practicing, what he'd seen happen is that people have rights, but they have no remedies. In other words, the police violate your rights, prison guards violate your rights, and you don't have any effective remedy to basically get compensation or to be made whole again. And, you know, this has basically been a very deliberate strategy at a lot of levels. The Supreme Court is a big culprit in terms of ensuring basically impunity for the government violating people's rights. And, you know, this has been kind of embedded at the state levels with a lot of so-called tort reform laws, damage caps for claims against the state. And, you know, we're just seeing this at a lot of levels so that, you know, basically whenever we have these cases where the government and its employees kill, brutalize, rape, or otherwise harm citizens, they've done a good job of cutting off a lot of the avenues of people getting relief and getting compensated for their injuries and made whole again in ways that didn't even exist 30 or 40 years ago.
Yeah. Go ahead, Kevin.
Well, I just would add that it's important for people to know that the culture around these sorts of awards, when they do work out, we've had a number in the state of Illinois work out where particularly for Chicago police and other officers in the state of Illinois, there were big, giant settlements awarded for wrongful convictions. And what you have is the culture of the Fraternal Order of Police going around and promoting this idea that they're some kind of victims of a witch hunt, or that there's some sort of kind of political game being played here by defense attorneys to enrich criminals. And so that's the way in which they view this process. And so that's very much, I think, the sort of ideology that may have been imposed on jury members in this case, and possibly why you could see such a small and really insulting sum awarded to a family.
Talking about a police state, I mean, there's that video. I want to talk about this for a moment. That video of that young 20-year-old woman at the Wildwood Beach in New Jersey by the ocean. They have these cops. You see them in the Ocean City or Rehoboth, all the East Coast or Northeast Coast beaches. They're the summer cops. And they can even carry guns. I mean, but they're just hired for the summer.
And they just walk up and down the beach.
They walk up and down the beach. They saw her. She's 20 years old. So she's not, quote, the legal drinking age. So they come upon her and they see on her beach blanket underneath her umbrella that she has a one unopened can of beer. And they get and they confront her and they say, give us your do a breathalyzer test. And she does it. And she passes because she hasn't had any alcohol. And then they keep saying, well, what's your name? Give us your name. We're taking you down. You have an illegal substance here. And she's like, no, blah, blah, blah. She finally says she doesn't want to talk to them. She hasn't done anything wrong. She's there on the beach, gone to the beach with one unopened beer can and 20 years old. And they start to confront her. And at a certain point, they say, okay, we're taking you down.
Mm-hmm.
And they jump her and they start beating her and strangling her on the beach.
Very violently. It's a very graphic video.
And now the Wildwood police are defending these summer cops who gratuitously carried out this attack on this woman. She's charged with like five significant crimes. Anyway, Paul, you've read about it. They're going to defend the cops, and I think they're going to go after her because as they're taking her down, as they're arresting her, you can see in the video she's putting her hands up like, stop. But apparently she made contact with one of the police, so she's charged with assault on police officer.
Right. I think that's typical. It's all, you know, charge the victim or blame the victim for basically their own beating and that. And one of the reasons that they do that is the Supreme Court came up with a case called Heck versus Humphrey around, I don't know, 20 years ago, that says that you can't fire that arrestees and civil rights plaintiffs, for example, can't file a lawsuit over an incident if a ruling in their favor would call into question the underlying conviction. So basically, by charging the victim in this case, who they're beating, with a crime, they then pressure the victims of the police assault to plead guilty to a minor charge, even if it involves no jail time or whatever, that will then make it very, very difficult, if not impossible, for them to file a lawsuit for damages over the brutality of the arrest or the beating or the other misconduct that they endured. So that's one of the reasons why they do that, and that's also why it's pretty much standard procedure. Then one of the other things that a lot of police departments do is they'll charge someone with a criminal offense knowing that it's bogus to cover up their misconduct. And then as part of a plea deal on the criminal charges, they'll agree to drop the criminal charges, but they want to get the victim of the assault or the victim of the attack to agree not to file a lawsuit over the beating or the misconduct that they endured. So these are all different ways in which the police state basically generates its own impunity. They don't even have to go to court. They're getting the impunity before anything is even filed, before anything can even be done. And oftentimes people, they don't have, they enter these agreements without the advice of counsel. And, you know, and it's not a very fair contest. You know, the police have literally the entire power and might of the police state behind them, whereas the individual is, well, just that, one individual.
That's the voice of Paul Wright. We're talking to Paul from Lake Worth, Florida. He's the founder and executive director of the Human Rights Defense Center. He's also the editor of Prison Legal News. We're also talking from Chicago with Kevin Gostala. Kevin is a writer for Shadowproof.com. He's the co-host of the podcast Unauthorized Disclosure. Kevin, let's talk about the story that you shared with us from Chicago, and it's on the Shadowproof website. Chicago City Council members lash out at young black activists opposed to Cop Academy. What's this story all about?
Yeah, so for people who are completely unaware, and that's entirely likely, there's a campaign with organizations throughout the U.S., but predominantly from the Chicago area in Illinois, who are protesting a $95 million police training academy. It'll also have training for firefighters and emergency responders or EMS. However, that's just sort of the gloss that Rahm Emanuel and others are putting on it to justify giving police this huge, massive compound that they're going to build on the West Side before they address accountability and oversight, before they actually straighten out the one thing that really does matter to people in the city, which is why do you keep shutting down schools that are in West Side and South Side neighborhoods and mostly low income and working class neighborhoods? Why do you keep shutting down mental health clinics? Why aren't you funding things that people need? And they fervently believe that they do not need more police. They're already hyper policed in these areas, and it has not had the effect of stopping and reducing crime to the extent that the city wants. So basically, they're using this recommendation from the Justice Department that suggested that the training facilities are inadequate, that things aren't really all that good as far as training, to justify pouring money into a $95 million facility. But what's remarkable is that as these organizers have gotten together and managed to make an issue out of it, they've really been vilified by several of the city council members, many of them black representatives. And, it's a mostly Democratic city anyways, so it doesn't really matter as far as political affiliation. They're going to defend law enforcement. And just trashed and acting like these people are not from the parts of the city that are going to be getting the center and might benefit. And just really ignoring the fact that what they're doing is using this public institution to do, which has been done in Chicago for several decades through the Daley administrations and then with Emanuel continuing it, using these public institutions to gentrify and create barriers between neighborhoods that other, predominantly white or affluent people might want to be able to create some space between them so that they're not threatened by what's going on in those neighborhoods. They used a college, the University of Illinois at Chicago. Mayor Richard J. Daley constructed it on the West Side and put it right in between downtown and these neighborhoods that had impoverished conditions, and that was done to protect the city. And it's happening again in the fact that they want to develop this region with this police training complex that is going to be massive. And then they're going to be able to control and contain a part of the city that suffers from a tremendous amount of poverty.
I want to stay with this issue a little bit because the debate, you can see how the debate will play out or why it's sort of directed, particularly in the black community. And as you said, some of the aldermen or people like Emma Mitz, African-American representative from West Garfield Park, are attacking the No Cop Academy Coalition. And she and the others are basically making the argument, your heart might be in the right place, but actually this is just an empty gesture. One, the police do need additional training. And if we don't have additional training, the instances of police abuse and police brutality, police misconduct will only continue to grow. It raises a lot of questions. Obviously, the argument will play in some sectors, Paul Wright. But let's just talk about the issue of what the police are actually trained to do. And it does vary to some extent from city to city based on the intensity or level of struggle, either political struggle or street struggle or legal struggles against the police. There are occasionally places where reforms have been adopted that whereby the police are retrained. Like, say, in Washington, D.C., when we used to have demonstrations, there were routinely and almost every time there would be an attack by the police. There would be people being beaten up. There would be people being arrested. There was a lot of kettling, mass arrests. And then there was litigation by the Partnership for Civil Justice in particular that got very, very big. It was long-term enduring litigation, but it was impact litigation, big settlements. And then the police, even more important perhaps than the monetary settlement, there was a retraining of the police. So instead of the police attacking demonstrators now, you basically can march through the street. You know, a parade permit is not necessary. There's very little or almost no confrontation now compared to the old days. The police retraining made a difference, but it seems when it comes to a black and working class communities, not necessarily about protest, the police training is and the way the police training goes, no matter what, is designed to indicate to the targeted community, hey, look, we, the cops, we're in control. We act with impunity. Is that right, or is there more nuance to this?
I think that's pretty much an accurate summation. I mean, I think that the big thing that we've seen around the country, especially when you see like police dealing with protesters where, you know, they've got the signs or they're chanting, you know, whose streets are streets and the whole back the blue thing. I mean, basically you've seen, basically it's almost like the police state degenerating into like street gangs. And the attitudes and the behavior that we see from a lot of law enforcement agencies, especially in big cities, it's something more reminiscent of what one would expect from literally juvenile street gangs rather than what you would expect from a law enforcement agency. And I think it's also one of the things, too, is that, you know, we live in what purports to be a democracy, yet basically the pillars of the state, which are literally the police, hence the police state part of it, you know, they don't really tolerate any criticism. They're pretty, the notion of free speech or criticism or questioning of the police state or of their misconduct or abuses is pretty much not very well tolerated, and they show literally no tolerance for anything that questions their behavior or anything like that. And that's pretty much across the board. And I think this kind of manifests itself in a lot of contexts when you talk about protests and mass arrests and stuff like that, is how much our political space for free speech has diminished in this country over the years. And I think that as someone who's, been around for a while, at this point I can say that, you know, 30 years ago, if you told people that if they wanted to protest or speak out against the government, that they would be herded into cages that would be euphemistically called free speech zones, miles away from anyone in a position of power who would notice or care, that would have been laughed off as being ludicrous. Who could imagine such a thing? If that's the norm around the country. And when we see the number of people that are arrested at things like rallies or demonstrations against police abuse, it's really, I think, very telling about the steps that are taken to, you know, silence any type of dissent. And what I find interesting is that when people in Iran protest their government, and they're suppressed by the police, that's viewed as the signs of a theological dictatorship, crushing dissent, and repressing the people's means of expression. Yet when protesters in this country are protesting police abuse in Oakland or Washington, D.C. or Chicago, and they're ruthlessly and violently attacked and suppressed by the organs of state security, that's not really meeting with much condemnation by the media. No one is seeing this as the bigger symptom of a democratic crisis.
Kevin, last word from you, and then we're going to turn to another issue in our last few minutes.
Well, yeah, I just want to add quickly that what happened here is there was a budget committee hearing, and what you're talking about is important about not allowing free speech. There was this opportunity to speak. They were supposed to have public comment. Even when the measure was going to pass 50-0 or 49-1, they don't want to hear dissent. They don't want to allow dissent. And so they pushed through the measure and they passed it. And they basically violated the Open Meetings Act. And they're going to continue to do this in the city because they don't want to listen to these people.
Yeah, let's go to another story. The headline is... it's from MichiganRadio.org. I think it's NPR. Despite increased state supervision, expert says private prison health care comes at a cost. And this is about a lawsuit in Michigan over the failure to provide basic health care for prisoners. Paul, go ahead.
Yes, and I think the failure to provide basic health care to prisoners, this is an ongoing outrage that's just been happening nationally for decades, if not centuries. And one of the things that a lot of state governments have tried to do in recent years is this whole notion of privatizing the health care. And part of the problem is that, quite literally, you know, the business model is, I think, fundamentally flawed in the sense that it's all premised upon collecting as much money as they can from the government and then providing as little money as or providing as little health care as possible. That's their basic business model. And that's what it's premised on. And yeah, we see this pattern of, you know, over and over again we see states that do this. They contract out their private health care, their medical care to private companies. Then there's a series of lawsuits, investigations, audits showing usually dozens of prisoners dying needlessly from, you know, very treatable, avoidable illnesses, and then the state will drop the contract. They'll switch it over to another country, to another company. The same thing happens, and then they start the whole process all over again. But it's just an ongoing process, and none of the companies are really any different, whether it's Wexford or Corizon or Correctional Services or Correctional Solutions. None of these companies offer anything approximating minimally adequate health care. Their whole premise is suck down as much tax money as they can and provide as little service as possible.
All right, we're going to leave it there. And that was the voice of Paul Wright. Paul was talking to us from Lake Worth, Florida. He's the founder and executive director of the Human Rights Defense Center. He's also the editor of Prison Legal News. I urge you to go to their website. We've also been joined from Chicago by Kevin Gostella. He's a writer for Shadowproof.com and co-host of the podcast Unauthorized Disclosure. This segment is heard every Thursday here on Loud and Clear. After a short break, we'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.